Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Wandering into Wellness. Ben and Lydia, your usuals. And this afternoon, we are really privileged to have Dr. Marilyn Glenville on the podcast for your ears and your edification. Marilyn is a great friend of ours at the HOPSAC, and we've known and worked with and been friends with for many years now. And Marilyn is a fertility and female hormonal health expert and nutritionist who specializes in those areas. And she's run a Harley Street medical clinic where she's looked at optimizing fertility through the use of nutritional practices for, I think it's a couple of decades at this stage.
Yeah,
And
three decades.
oh, I didn't want to say three, but three, there you go. So there are not very many people on the planet who are as well versed or as well predisposed or in a better place to talk about nutrition and fertility as you. So I would love to know, first off, Marilyn, and welcome. And what is it when we talk about optimizing natural fertility?
It's then making small changes around lifestyle, nutrition. Also looking at emotions as well. There's a lot of research on that, particularly things like stress. And then we're also, when we think of optimizing fertility, working on female and male fertility as well. But it's small shifts and really practical things that people can do that do optimize their fertility. And then giving them the chance of when they're ready to conceive by making those changes now, because they may be planning a year or so's time, but it's optimizing that fertility ready for when they want to conceive. And that's really important. And also optimizing fertility for those who may be going for IVF for whatever reason they're going down that route, because it actually may and can increase the chances of that IVF being more successful. So whatever they do in the natural field for optimizing fertility is never wasted, and it's going to put them on that journey for whatever they might need, but we're always aiming to help them conceive naturally.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that was perfectly encapsulated. That's brilliant. That's basically a dictionary definition. So talk to us about when you're about to come to Dublin to host a seminar in conjunction with us, which is really exciting. And what I understand you're going to be trying to do to help people to translate how fertility, really optimizing natural fertility, actually operates far beyond the bounds of just conception and the want to conceive, but that it actually has ramifications for kind of whole life health. So can you explain a little bit about the broader topic of what will happen when people start to optimize natural fertility? What are the other effects on their health that they're going to see?
Well, when you think of fertility and we think of those reproductive hormones and that roller coaster that every woman is on every month. So by optimizing her fertility, it's also balancing those hormones generally across the month. And then we look at the impact that those hormones have on her. And they are like an orchestra, and they're filtering out to every system in the body, including mental health, but also everything around her energy, metabolism, skin, moods, everything connected to it. So by optimizing fertility, we're actually balancing the hormones generally. And that is really important for women who may have an underlying hormone imbalance like polycystic ovaries, endometriosis. And in their mind, they are worried about fertility because those conditions can actually impact negatively. So by getting that harmony with those hormones is actually then working on optimizing their fertility in the future, but changing the condition that's actually causing that hormone imbalance now. So again, it's just wonderful what can be done in terms of what we can do naturally.
I think so. In terms of women with PCOS or endometriosis or those sorts of really debilitating conditions, one of the sorts of symptoms that they are suffering that maybe that can be supported by managing their hormones that are going to help with conception.
Yeah, so when you think about polycystic ovary syndrome, the issue is the woman's not ovulating. So her ovaries will look like a bunch of grapes. So there's little small follicles on there, but not one of them becomes dominant in order to ovulate. So it is a big impact on fertility and getting pregnant. So by changing that hormone imbalance that's actually causing the PCOS and all the symptoms that go with it, not just the problems with ovulation, but it's the excess hair, it's the weight, can be skin conditions. And the same with endometriosis. It may be impacting how the egg can be released or whether it implants. So again, a hormonal imbalance is actually affecting that woman's fertility. So when we go a step back and create that harmony with those hormones, were changing her potential fertility for the future.
Okay, and so, and obviously those conditions have a necessary effect in terms of the, you know, when they're, obviously their anxiety levels, their nervous system is going to be activated, because like you say, they're thinking of down the tracks and how this is going to affect the rest of their life and their ability to conceive. Obviously, so that drives some part of the anxiety, but the actual sex hormones themselves affect our mood as well, don't they? So it's kind of like a double whammy.
They do, and that estrogen and progesterone that's on that roller coaster during the month. And when you think of one of the classic symptoms or issues that women can have, we've got premenstrual syndrome. It used to be called premenstrual tension, and that's happening 7 to 10 days before the period for a lot of women. And there's about 150 different symptoms that go with it. But it's not, and the diagnosis is tricky because it's not done on any blood tests, it's done on timing. When the symptoms come and when do they go? But the impact is both physical and mental. So it's a real impact on the women's moods, on food cravings, on not being able to sleep. And women can have very subtle changes, but some women get it very severe. And it really feels like they're Jekyll and Hyde in those few days. And this is what these reproductive hormones are actually causing, complete shifts around with how that woman is feeling and also thinking. They can feel quite dark. They just feel that everything's very negative, and then it lifts up as soon as the period comes. But it can be very extreme for some women.
Functioning sleep there.
Oh.
Reproductive hormones affect sleep. Like, how might that manifest? And what are the changes that you can see with changes in diet that might be positive?
Yeah, so they may be finding it difficult to get off to sleep. Some will have a combination of variations. Some will actually be waking in the middle of the night. And oftentimes we see that in the clinic. It's almost like an adrenaline surge, waking them up in the middle of the night. They may get palpitations. And then because they are concerned that they're going to work, they've got to be up in the morning, then they can often be lying there for a few hours. And so that's impacting their energy the next day. And then oftentimes they may be using energy drinks, caffeine, and going around in a bit of a vicious circle in order to manage that sleep deprivation. So when women are saying, well, I've not got much energy, the question also has to be, are you sleeping okay? Because it may be the lack of sleep that's causing the lack of energy. And then round and round they go. So it can have a huge impact. And again, it's because of these transition with the hormones through this cycle, which can have such a huge impact on her physically and mentally.
And you're like, you did mention like dietary strategies, like what sort of specific things, obviously you're speaking in generalities here because each individual case is so different, but what sort of strategies do you see start to change people's sort of sleep based on like eating for hormonal health, I guess?
Yes, and actually some of it can be quite powerful in that even though we're talking about women, say, with PCOS, PMS, maybe endometriosis, so they almost look like opposite conditions, with PCOS being more of dominance of male hormones, endometriosis more of dominance of female. And yet, if we look at what the underlying cause is and we address blood sugar imbalances, cortisol, which comes out with adrenaline, one of the stress hormones, can actually be impacting in terms of how the body uses progesterone. So some women can end up being estrogen dominant because another hormone system in the body is actually interfering with their female hormones. And sometimes we take a step back and think, what is this underlying cause? How do we address that nutritionally? Because that can be the root cause for a lot of female hormone imbalances, and including making sure to optimize fertility. So it's sometimes very straightforward, practical steps that can make a huge difference for all women, even though they may manifest as different hormonal issues. Yeah.
I've been reading a lot of recently about cortisol's effects on menstrual cycle and female reproductive hormones and how it can affect them. If it also affects the male reproductive hormones as well, though, and if it does, in what ways might that manifest?
Yeah, you're thinking of men and whether it could affect sperm health, that sort of thing. Yeah, and I've actually seen that in the clinic, and I was seeing a lovely couple, and his sperm semen analysis was actually fine. And we repeated it after 3 months. And normally we see, you know, an improvement, but it actually crashed down. And talking to him, he had this bereavement, a sudden bereavement in the family. And it was such a huge impact for him that that stress had actually changed that sperm count, the quality of the sperm. And it was almost like a barometer of being able to see what had gone on in his life. So, yes, we talk about stress for women's cycles, because in the extreme, it can stop a cycle completely. So I can see young women in the clinic who are, yes, wanting to optimize their fertility. They're thinking of conception in the future, but their cycle has stopped. And obviously, you're not going to get pregnant if that's happened. But when we look at the stress hormones, our reproductive system is the only system it can shut down without killing us. So in terms of trauma, in terms of a sudden thing that's happening, in order to conserve our energy, the body can actually stop the cycle. In a more subtle way, it can stop ovulation and the period still carries on. But in the extreme, and I've seen women in their 20s where, because they've gone through a bereavement, car accident, something very sudden, the cycle could stop for up to 6 months while the body's trying to compensate and give that woman those resources to cope with what's happened in her life. So that cortisol connection is very powerful, both for men and women. Yeah, really powerful.
That's a really, really great illustration. And one of the things we talk about a lot in the shop is how, with our immune systems as well, we have often this situation where people will go under a very extremely stressful event. They won't, the body won't let themselves get sick. And as soon as the stressful event ends, all of these immune system stuff cascade starts to happen. Will we see the same thing with reproductive hormones? Like, when you start to support reproductive hormones and the cycles, do you start to see improvements in immunity? Do you see changes there?
Yes, and it all comes back again. And you're completely right, Finn. That is quite something very noticeable, that it's like the body can hold on, just about hold on, while that stressful event is happening with the immune system. And then there's this complete collapse. It's like letting go. You know, I've got over this, and it just lets go. And then that's when people are, you know, really unwell, because they've held on and the body's held on through whatever stressful event. But that immune system side of it is really interesting, because they're now looking at why some women don't get pregnant or why they miscarry. And the huge amount of research is on the woman's immune system. And looking at the research, we have a much stronger immune system than men. And that's why women are more prone to autoimmune conditions. So we do joke around about man flu, that when men get the flu, you know, they're flawed, but we're carrying on. But joking aside, there is this good research that we have a stronger immune system, but it also means we have more antibodies. It means we're more prone to autoimmune conditions. And one of the areas on not getting pregnant or miscarrying is that that woman's immune system is too strong, and it can't then accept foreign DNA from either a partner or a sperm donor, because the immune system has to suppress slightly in order for a woman to get pregnant and stay pregnant. And we have a huge amount of research now on vitamin D, because it is an immune modulator. We have to absolutely test every woman for vitamin D deficiency. But most important, if she's struggling to get pregnant, wants to optimize her fertility, miscarrying, and also thinking about omega-3s and blood flow to the baby as well. So huge amount of research now on how the immune system can be affecting fertility, but also women's conditions like autoimmune problems like lupus, that sort of thing. But really interesting, that connection with those reproductive hormones and what's going on with the immune system.
Interesting.
You were just talking about miscarrying, and I think miscarriage is such an under-talked about thing and an under-understood thing. And I've had a few friends recently who have miscarried once or twice, and it's had a massive effect on their relationships, their cycles, their digestive health, their emotional health, their stress levels, their sleep. There's so much more that it seems to affect. So can you talk a little bit into how it might affect someone and why it might affect them, so that if someone was listening and their partner's realizing that they seem completely different after a miscarriage. Maybe a partner doesn't understand quite why, especially if it was a very early miscarriage, that might have had an impact on them. Can you explain that?
And usually those ones are happening before the 12th week of pregnancy, because past the 12th week, the placenta's taking over. Up until that time, the hormones are holding the baby there. But when we think about it, it is a bereavement, and I don't think it's thought of that much because it's happening, like you said, Lydia, so early on. And over here, and might be the same in Ireland as well, women have to have 3 miscarriages before they can start to get investigated on our national health system. And that is really hard because the women coming into the clinic are saying, I don't want to go through this again. What do I do now to work on prevention? So it is a huge loss. And they're thinking, you know, have they done something wrong? And it's actually helping them emotionally as well as physically to actually optimize their fertility. Because what we're doing for optimizing fertility is also reducing the risk of miscarriage, because we put everything in place not only to help them get pregnant, but to stay pregnant as well. So everything we're doing around optimizing fertility is actually helping to safeguard that further miscarriage. But it's not looked at very much, and it's not often seen as a bereavement, which can really affect the couple's relationship and how they deal with it. And maybe they need, you know, counselling or to talk it through, so there's an understanding of why they feel like that, because it does seem so early on, but it is that, you know, there's grief attached to it. There definitely is.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, and grief is such an impact. We understand so little about it because we box it off into societal systems like funerals and these sorts of things. We go, okay, that part's done, move on. But it really worked like that. And we know from cultures that work more traditionally how long they allow that grieving process to take place over, like sometimes 3 or 5 years. They'll keep the actual body in the home until they have a second funeral, and then they release the thing. So I think, yeah, there's so much that we can't really understand. We don't allow time for, I suppose, in our current kind of societal trend, for it to take place. And that's really, I think the acknowledgement of it is such a big deal as well. It's the acknowledgement opens the floodgates for these sorts of things as well. And the point of conversation, like you're saying, so that somebody who be in that position where their wife or partner has had miscarriage and they just see this change, and often that change can bring distance. And that's the thing you want to really, I guess, avoid, isn't it? In terms of like closing down communication.
And recently women have asked for a certificate of that loss. They've now asked to actually have something in writing that shows they have lost a baby, and that they feel will be helpful. And like you said, Finn, when you look at other cultures, there is often a huge release in terms of vocally how they're expressing that grief. But we don't do that to the same extent. It's more, you know, sort of the stiff upper lip and that sort of thing. So there's a very different way, depending on the culture, of how they're managing the loss of somebody. Yes, very different.
I think also there's that his body understands that there's been a loss, but sometimes the emotions haven't caught up. Sometimes you don't even know that you were pregnant before you've lost that baby.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of a dissonance between those two things to try to somatically understand what's happened. And then, of course, it can be very hard for the partner if they didn't know you were pregnant in the first place.
Yeah.
And then that's them. And then there's this distance between where I'm at and where they're at, and there's change, right? But also something that's been in the news a lot recently is that the idea, this scientific idea, that every baby that a woman is pregnant with, some of the baby's cells go into the mother's body and alter her brain and different parts of the body forever. So actually every single baby, no matter how early on, has literally changed the mother's body. So it's natural that that would have an impact.
Yes, definitely. And it's how we help the women deal with that, and also then help work on prevention so they're not having to go through it again. And that's really important. And when we do think of miscarriage, and 1 in 4 women can miscarry, but all the focus goes on the woman. But nature is always working on survival of the fittest. So we also have to ask, is the sperm okay? Whether it's coming from a donor or whether it's coming from her partner, is the sperm as healthy as it can be? Because nature will still cause a miscarriage from what's going on with the sperm as well. So with a miscarriage, we are always thinking we have to optimize fertility for both of them to work on prevention. Because if something's not 100% with the sperm, it can have two heads, two tails. Nature may not let that pregnancy continue, and the focus needs to be on both of them to optimize fertility and their health before they're actually conceiving again.
Yeah. So one of the things that made me so interested in having you over to talk about this particular topic, which is how impactful the focus on fertility can be to support people's life entirely, men and women, not just women. This, we really want to broaden it out that way. But one of the reasons, because of the decline in fertility, and you were saying there's a, was it, did you say a 50% drop in males' sperm motility or sperm count?
And
you?
Over the last 10 years, it's come out fairly recently, and they're looking at environmental causes, diet, huge impact it's going to have on male health as well. So yes, huge drop, 50%. Yeah.
Wow. So with that in mind, and the fact that there's this drop in fertility that doesn't just affect your ability to have babies, but also that drop in fertility means that's a red flag for the rest of your entire body system, for your physiology, your biology. It's all going to suffer as a result of this drop off in sex hormone health or reproductive hormone health. And what are some of the sort of do's and don'ts, let's say, if we can lay the groundwork for people who are coming at it maybe earlier than where they're really, you know, their eyes aren't laser focused on having kids. Could you maybe guide us through some of those?
And I think we have to look at the dietary side, and that's really important. And there's good research. We always talk about the Mediterranean diet, but it comes up a lot in the literature that by having this, eating a rainbow has also been a big concept, talking about men's fertility as well, is that we should be eating this rainbow. I know years ago, our parents, it was eat our greens, but we're going a step further now of this colourful array that we get from all the different fruits and vegetables. And they're giving us the antioxidants. So they're working on sperm health, quality and quantity. And what's really interesting for women, and I don't think they always realise this, that although we are born with our egg supply, we've got an ovarian reserve already there when we're born. And so women are concerned about time and the, you know, the biological clock. But as long as a woman's ovulating, yes, we can't change that egg reserve, that egg store, but we can change the quality. So with men, we can work on quality and quantity, because men, you produce sperm all of your life. But with women, yes, they're thinking, well, you know, I can't do anything, but you can actually change the quality of eggs. And we have a 3-month window of opportunity to do that, because it takes 3 months for the egg to mature, ready for ovulation. So we have a lot of potential. Women may not realize that that potential is there, and including all of these antioxidants, we talked about omega-3s, things like coenzyme Q10, huge amount of research on how we can improve egg quality for women, but also it's mirroring the same nutrients for the man, but working on their reproductive hormones and that semen quality. So it's just the research is really moving along quickly about how we can make an impact on optimizing fertility for whenever the man and the woman are ready to actually want to conceive.
I love what you're saying about the eating the rainbow as well. There's so much that we're beginning to understand about how polyphenols actually, as well, like they don't necessarily work as antioxidants in the traditional sense. They actually work as, to some degree, hormetic stressors, where they actually stress the body out so the body becomes better at protecting itself. And one of the things I was reading this morning around fiber and the mic, because the microbiome is such a big part of conception, fertility. And I remember, I think one of the first things I heard from you, or the one of the most impactful early things I heard from you, was that one of the biggest impacts you saw on a woman's ability to conceive and hold a pregnancy was actually whether she was constipated or not. And because constipation, because it provides a physical blockage, and because it means it's affecting so much about the detoxification processes, but that has such an effect. And we're beginning to understand about how the microbiome then affects immune cells in the gut. Yes, I was reading a thing this morning, which I thought was exciting, a study, I think it was an Italian study, where they introduced inulin at different quantities, and it showed, I think 10 to 15 grams of inulin taken over 6 weeks daily increased bifidobacteria by 50% and dropped off two of the more pathogenic bacteria by some similar value. And like, maybe could you talk to us a little bit about that idea about detoxification and fertility, that again, it's not just around having babies, but how that has sex hormone health?
And that real connection now, yes, it's gut and brain, so we know it's going to affect a person's mental health by making sure that those that gut microbiome is as optimal as it can be. But also we now, and they call it, it's got an American terminology, the estrobilome. So there is this system within the gut bacteria that help us metabolize estrogen efficiently. And this is crucial for any woman with PCOS, fibroids, endometriosis. So this is going to enable hormone balance by what's going on in the digestive system. And, you know, often women will think, well, why are we talking about my digestive system when it's my hormones I want to get in balance? But it's that part of it, because we've got to detoxify the hormones via the liver, and then the digestive system has got to eliminate them. And if those beneficial bacteria aren't in balance, those hormones are going to recirculate. So you're right, it's this whole getting the whole integrated approach to what's going on physically and mentally, and addressing all those different aspects, just gives everybody a chance to get their hormones in balance, but optimizing fertility for whenever they're ready to want to conceive. But they've got that set in place, and it just gives them a much better chance when they are ready to want to get pregnant.
Yeah.
It's interesting, is it? Because I think for some people listening, like I said, it can be a really kind of esoteric concept, the idea that nutrition can have enough of an impact on menstrual cycle or just general all body health. But what I do see, what most people have understood, is that if you're thin or if you're overweight, things can either stop your periods or make problems with your periods and affect fertility and also then whole body health, right? So we know that that's true. But of course, then diet and nutrition is affecting the global body as a whole.
And we've always thought, you know, when you think of a male fertility, we now know that overweight and higher body mass index, but higher fat percentage, is going to affect sperm as well. So you're right, you've got these two extremes, particularly for women. And there are certain cutoffs in IVF clinics that if a woman's BMI is at a certain level, they won't allow her to go through the IVF because they know it's not going to be successful. She's basically wasting her time and money. So there is often a cutoff for body mass index. But it is the other extreme as well, that if women are over exercising, under eating, not getting enough of the total nutrients that we actually need, and all the fat, protein, carbohydrates, and their body fat percentage goes too low, as we might see with a young girl gymnast or something, the cycle will stop. Women have got to have about 17% body fat at least in order to keep the reproductive hormones going. Otherwise, the cycle will stop. So when there's a lot of media pressure to be, you know, very slim, you know, a lot of keeping off certain foods and maybe over-exercising as well, we have to just be a bit careful, because it's not healthy for women to go down to such a low body percentage, because the cycle will just stop. It can't keep that going. It needs those fat cells in order to keep those reproductive hormones going.
I remember one of the things I learned from Lid, actually, around, because I live and work in a world where, you know, orthorexia is a reality. So that notion that, you know, there's no such thing as being too healthy, just the more things you add on, the better. And there's no kind of end to that. But I remember one of the things I learned from Lid around particularly female body health around pregnancy and conception and labor was that not only being too skinny is a problem, but actually being too muscly is a problem, because muscularity leads to hypertone, and hypertone is not what you need when it comes to labor. And it's another point that gets missed so often in the media, because we're like, okay, no, it's strong over skinny, that's okay, we moved away from this body image problem, but actually we moved towards another body image problem, which is presenting a whole other set of barriers for women when they want to go and to have a healthy pregnancy, healthy labor, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I don't think we don't think about that enough. And I think, like you were saying, the image, the body image that's presented to us in the media for women especially has changed vastly in the last like 70 years. Like, what was a healthy, sexy looking woman, the optimal body type, Sophia Loren, those kind of people? When you look back at the pictures of them, they were in size 14.
Yes, I'm very curvy.
Be curvy. And that idea is skinny, but really, really strong, really, really fit. And, you know, obviously I'm in an industry where fitness is appreciated and I believe in being fit and exercise and being healthy, but it's finding that balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you're being too far into the masculine, working into those masculine hormones too much. But like you said, on a practical level, if someone's listening and they really want to be pregnant, when you're pregnant and you have a lot of tone in your core, you're always going to have, not always, but often you're going to have problems then with abdominal diastasis or diastasis retching because you're very, very tight there and the body has to stretch. And if there's too much tone, that's required. And then on the other side of the abdomen, the pelvic floor, if you do a lot of exercise, often we get hypertonic in the pelvic floor. And that pelvic floor needs to soften and relax and relieves with the pushing stage at birth. And if it isn't, we are much more likely to have tears and then the shaming afterwards in the optimal. So there's loads of different things. And well, it's about, like you were saying, I think, and the message that we seem to be getting from you is it's balance. For health in all areas of life and fertility, it's always about finding that middle ground and that balance.
Yeah. And because there's a lot of push on fasting at the moment, and I think it can be very beneficial, but it needs to be done in the right way in order to keep a woman's hormones in balance and optimize fertility. So it's got to be done in a way that doesn't shock her body into a survival mode when she's going down to maybe 600 calories if she's doing a 5-2 diet, something like that. So it is this balance. We don't want them to get into this disordered eating. We want women to be able to eat healthily, optimize the fertility, optimize their hormones, and yet still, you know, be eating well and getting all the nutrients they need. And we can still put in certain aspects of fasting where they get all the health benefits, but without shocking their body into thinking there's a famine going on and it's going into a survival mode, which is too much of a stress on the system. So it is a question of balance and just helping women to understand what they need to be eating in order to optimize their fertility for the future. But also what it's helping is optimizing their health, physical and mental, at this moment in time when they're getting those hormones in balance, because it affects every system in their body. We've talked about sleep, moods, immunity, food cravings. Everything is affected by those hormones. And it's then getting those in balance then, which allows that woman to get pregnant when she's ready and the time is right for her, depending on, you know, what her situation is in life.
If someone's listening and they're really interested in this and they want to come to your talk, but they're also wanting to get started now, is there three foods that a woman can start to include in their diet today that would help their own health and their reproductive health as well?
Yeah, so I would say, and I know it might sound counterproductive, but I would put in phytoestrogens, and they're the things we get from the legumes. I know everybody focuses on soya, but it needs to be organic soya, but things like lentils, chickpeas, flax seeds, and because the wording implies an estrogenic action, they don't work like that. They actually work on balancing hormones, and they work on balancing hormones for men as well. When we see the men in those cultures that eat these, they don't get the same prostate cancer death as we have in the West. So we think about them as balancing hormones. Also think about putting in this eating a rainbow, so lots of different colours. I'd also think about the omega-3 fatty acids as well. So either coming from flax seeds or oily fish if somebody's eating animal foods. Egg yolks contain good amounts. And I would absolutely put in a multivitamin and mineral that's designed for fertility, designed for optimizing hormone balance. So that's got everything in, including the folate, the zinc, the selenium, the coenzyme Q10 as well. So I'd put that in too. And I formulated the supplements for the natural health practice. And I know you also stock them in the hop sack, but it would be getting a good multi that contains everything, putting in omega-3 and also vitamin C, and including all those nutrients with their food as well. And that would be a really good start to make sure that they're not deficient in everything, in anything at all.
Part three would be using the rainbow, so all of those would be themes in multiple colours, a native terrenes, and then the phytoestrogens.
And the phytoestrogens, yes. And having as much variety as possible, because I know everybody thinks about soya, but when we think of all the cultures around the world, they've all got one of these dominant beans. We can think of the dal, the lentils from India. We've got black beans from Costa Rica. You've got the chickpeas and hummus from the Middle East, soya, China and Japan. So these cultures have eaten these phytoestrogens for centuries. So to include those, flax seeds on porridge, hummus at lunchtime, lentil soup, it's just that variety because we get different, what we call isoflavones, from the different beans. But they are really important. The fibre, like you were talking about, Finn, the fibre also is helping with that digestive system and the gut microbiome. So, and it's including all the fruit and vegetables, healthy protein, whether it's plant-based or animal, whatever their choice is. But the omega-3s coming in, we now know is crucial because of the control on inflammation, which may be affecting a woman's ability to actually get pregnant or stay pregnant. But the impact that inflammation can have on things like period pains, endometriosis, male fertility as well. So it's how these foods that we think about are really good for optimizing fertility are actually changing the way the hormones, the reproductive hormones work, and that woman's and the man's general health, both physically but also mentally as well. So a huge impact, and it doesn't have to be, you know, enormous changes, but those small steps, I have to say, from the years I've been working in this field, make such a difference in such a small space of time.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. That's been like, I've like, this is the sort of information that I love you for, because it's so much. And it's, yet it's distilled so well in such a way that, you know, feels actionable. I mean, I know as you're talking, I'm thinking through my cupboards downstairs. I'm thinking, okay, lentils, yeah, dal, I could have to, you know, you're trying to, the things that you talk about are things that resound simple. And that's, I think, the beauty of the changes that you're offering to people. It's all that requires is the willpower. It's certainly not, they're not expensive changes. They're fundamental, but they're also like very actionable, very, very, very simple. So, for those who would like to work directly with you, I know you work with a clinic in Ireland as well called Glenville Nutrition, right? The bars as well.
So they're on glenvillenutrition.ie, and Heather Leeson is the director of the clinic. And hopefully, and I know she will be, she'll come and talk about a case study on April the 10th when I'm over. So she'll talk about a case study from the clinic as well. And also, there will be lots of time for questions. So there will be personal questions that people will have in the audience. And like always, there'll be time during a break and we won't be rushing off after. So Heather and I will be there. So we will share whatever, you know, concern you have on a one-to-one basis, as well as from the audience as well. So it's all about just giving people whatever they need and making time for them, because it's such an opportunity to come over and be at the HOPSAC. So really, really looking forward to it. And it's such a brilliant topic to expand this out to how it can help women just generally, but also that optimizing fertility for whenever it's ready for them to begin a family.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us. Really looking forward to April the 10th. And it's like, and so much of your information also stretches out to like me and guys, and I'd love more guys to come along to this as well. Guys with your partners and without partners, it's going to be all about like what, like fundamentally this change is for everybody to make, that are going to support immunity, sleep, stress, all these sorts of good things. So April the 10th, hopefully we'll see you there. Link Star Eventbrite and also Marilyn Sure through NHP, etc.
Yep.
And thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you very, very shortly.
Nice to see you both, Finn and Lydia. See you in April.
Nice to see you done. Thanks, Lydia. Bye.